Well, greetings to all my faithful listeners. Radio Solar System is back again. Hopefully you've digested the stuff in the first class of this module, the basic science concepts, and hopefully many of you knew this stuff already. What we're going to do in the second part of this is talk about some background concepts in Earth science. So we're going to revisit or visit things that you need to know. If you've done a first year Earth science course or something like that, a lot of this stuff will be familiar to you, but possibly not all of it. If you haven't, then you certainly need to spend some time looking at this material. Now, for the first little bit of this presentation, we're going to talk a little bit about energy. This is something else that relates to more basic science principles. And then we're going to outline some concepts that relate to geology and earth science that are going to be particularly important to understand as we go through this course. So once again, every time you need to move the slide, you'll hear this distinctive sound. So we can move along now and have a look at the first slide, which is just a list of the things that we're going to do. We're going to talk a little bit, first of all, about energy in the universe. We have a whole section of the course or a whole class on this later on, but we need to introduce a few basic things so you're familiar with them. We're going to talk about the essential structure of the Earth and an important concept, what we call the lithosphere, which is the outermost region of silicate planets. We need to understand what this is and how it's defined. I'm going to talk about minerals, rocks, and some other key aspects of Earth sciences, things that geologists do and things that geologists look for. And we'll talk also about the rock cycle and plate tectonics very briefly. We'll come back to these topics later on. Essentially, reasons for the dynamic nature of the Earth and why it is such an active planet compared to many of the other ones that we will later visit. So let's move right along. We won't waste any time with this. Energy in the solar system. Some concepts. Just a real introduction here. Well, obviously, we've got energy on the Earth. We've got energy in the Earth. We have volcanic eruptions, and we have rain and thunderstorms and hurricanes like Hurricane Ida. So where's all this energy come from, and how do we make use of it as scientists? Second thing that's important about energy is that we can't visit everywhere we'd like to go. So the data and information that comes from remote sensing is crucially important in planetary science. And these methods are really effectively are sensing and analyzing energy. So we're going to look at a few major points about energy, which should be familiar to you, but need to perhaps be reinforced and placed in a slightly different context. So let's move along to the next slide. This is slide 4. Well, the most obvious energy source you can think of in the solar system is the sun. That provides the energy that essentially preserves and drives the Earth's surface environment. The sun gets its energy from what we call nuclear fusion. It basically turns hydrogen into helium. We can analyze its output. It can tell us a lot about stuff. Now, planets obviously have internal energy too. Earth has plenty of internal energy. We can see this every time a volcano erupts. Some planets have lost much of their internal energy. Where does that internal energy come from? Well, it comes from a couple of sources. One important source is really leftover energy or leftover heat from the processes that form planets in the first place, billions of years ago. But we also have a component that comes from radioactive decay, from the decay of radioactive elements in the interior of planets, which generates energy. And remember I said in the last class that in the early days of the solar system, there were a lot of short-lived energetic radioactive isotopes around that provided quite a lot of energy. So those are the two most obvious energy sources that we can perhaps think about. But there are others that we need to consider too. So now let's have a look at the next slide. So we got plenty of kinetic energy in the solar system too. That's a comet. Comets move extremely fast. They're some of the fastest things that pass through the solar system. If one of them should hit the Earth, we'd be in big trouble. So where does that energy come from? Planets are moving around in orbits around the sun. Comets are moving through at even faster rates. Where's that coming from? Well, that energy also is inherited from the time of formation of the solar system. Okay? And we'll talk more about this when we talk about models for formation of the solar system. But what governs the movement of these objects? Well, principally, it's the force of gravity. Okay? Gravity is the energy source that gives the kinetic energy that applies to objects within the solar system and predicts how they're going to behave. So later on in this course, we'll talk about the laws of motion, Newton's laws of motion, the laws of gravity, and how they can be applied. So that's another source of energy that we have to consider as well, kinetic energy. So let's just say a few more things about some of these things and get into a little bit more detail, but not a whole lot of detail at this stage. So now to the next slide. You've all heard of the electromagnetic spectrum. Electromagnetic energy is what solar energy is, and it's what stellar energy is too. The light that comes from the stars is electromagnetic energy. And we can produce this by a range of different things. We can produce it by combustion. Your fire is producing electromagnetic energy. Radioactive decay is another one. Now, in many ways, electromagnetic energy is a bit of a contradiction. We tend to talk about it as waves. We talk about light waves. We talk about X-rays and things like that. But in other times, we think about energy packets that we call photons. It has a dual nature, and I don't want to get into the details of this because they can be somewhat confusing. They relate to a process called quantum mechanics, but nevertheless, we'll stick for the moment with the concepts of energy waves and energy rays because it makes things a little bit easier. So what we do with electromagnetic energy in planetary science is analyze the spectra that come from different types of solar system objects, which are largely reflected spectra, and also, of course, from stars themselves, which produce energy. And it's a very important source of knowledge in planetary science. So now to the next slide. We can think of electromagnetic radiation as having two wave components, what we call electrical and magnetic, that vibrate at right angles. And we have two important measures for electromagnetic energy. We have a measure called wavelength, and that's the distance between the wave crests. And for most of the energy forms that we're interested in, that's quite a short distance. Frequency is a measure of how many wave crests pass a spot in a given time. So I think you can see that frequency and wavelength are closely related. The shorter the wavelength, the more wave crests will pass a spot in a given time, so the higher the frequency. As we discussed in the previous class, electromagnetic radiation propagates at an extremely high speed in a vacuum, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, which is the speed of light. Now to the next slide. This is the electromagnetic spectrum, which you should have a general familiarity with from previous exposure to science courses. We define electromagnetic radiation in terms of wavelength and frequency, and they're inversely correlated. So 1 hertz, for example, is 1 cycle per second. Okay, that's the measure of frequency, and a wavelength is a measure of the distance between wave crests. As the wavelength gets shorter, or the frequency gets higher, same thing, electromagnetic radiation becomes more energetic. So over at the right-hand side of that diagram, you have things like gamma rays and X-rays, which we know to be hazardous. At the left-hand end, you have things like AM radio waves and FM radio waves, which are not particularly hazardous to us. In the middle somewhere, we have visible light. Visible light's a very small region that's in the middle of the electromagnetic spectrum. And that's what we look at mostly through telescopes, but of course today's telescopes also look at a wide range of other types of electromagnetic radiation as well. They are not restricted to visible light. So now to the next slide. This is slide 9. Using the electromagnetic spectrum, how do we use it? Well, objects produce a wide range of frequencies. The sun produces a lot of electromagnetic energy, but it gives us ultraviolet and infrared, as well as visible light. It also gives us some X-rays too. Okay, so there's stuff that's coming from the sun that we can't see. We can't see ultraviolet light, but we can feel its effects. It can give us sunburn. We can feel infrared too. This turns out that there's a very good relationship between the temperature of any radiant object, like the sun, and the frequency or wavelength of the radiation that it emits. So that very easily gives us a way to figure out the temperature of a distant star, or the sun, or anything really for that matter. Objects also will show different features in different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's quite easy for us to look at the surface of Mars or the surface of the Moon with visible light. We can't do that with the planet Venus because it's obscured by clouds, but we can see the surface of Venus by using radar, which is a longer wavelength radiation, which allows us to see some aspects of Venus's surface and topography. The other important thing about electromagnetic radiation is that atoms, ions, and molecules all respond to electromagnetic energy. They will absorb energy in clearly defined ways, and they can also emit energy in clearly defined ways. And we'll talk more about this as we go through the course. So these give us things that we can find out compositions from, We can have ways of estimating the composition of objects, not just objects that emit energy, but objects that radiate energy too. We can get information back from that, because some of the material in those things will absorb certain frequencies or certain wavelengths of energy. So all of this stuff comes under the general heading of what we call spectroscopy. And we'll talk about this specifically in a future class. And we're going to make much use of this in terms of understanding the solar system and the objects within it. So now to the next slide. This just shows some different images of the Crab Nebula, which is a remnant of a supernova. It's a remnant of an exploded star. And you can see that it has quite a different appearance if we look at it in the X-ray region of the spectrum versus the visible region of the spectra versus the infrared or the radio region of the spectrum. Okay? So different kinds of energy give us different kinds of information and very important information. And we can see. Note that the stars disappear in the radio image because they're not emitting very much in that region of the electromagnetic spectrum. So different radiation gives different information. That's really the message from this. And now to the next slide, which is slide 11. As I said before, that this also applies to Venus as well. Okay, we can use ultraviolet radiation or ultraviolet measurements to look at its cloud layers. We can see the structure of the clouds of Venus very clearly in UV. Visible light, we can't see too much at all, but what we call microwave radar starts to bring out surface features that we can see on Venus. Some of those round things that you see there are huge volcanic complexes on the surface of Venus that we're able to see with radar, but not with other methods. It's particularly important to do this in the case of Venus, because as you will find out when we get to Venus later on in the course, it's not likely that any human being will ever set foot on Venus because of the surface conditions. So that's just a quick little survey of energy and electromagnetic energy particularly and its uses in planetary science. So what we're going to do now is shift gears a little bit and start to talk a little bit about some principles of geological science. So let's go to the next slide. This is slide 12. From atoms to molecules, making minerals. In the previous class, we talked a little bit about the structure of atoms. Well, obviously, atoms do exist in their raw condition, on themselves in nature, but for the most part, atoms exist in combinations that we call compounds. We're familiar with many of these compounds from everyday life. Well, minerals are the building blocks of rocks and the building blocks of terrestrial planets. They're simply chemical compounds that occur in nature. Some minerals are simple, some of them are very complicated. And the term molecule is important to understand too. That's the smallest unit into which a compound can be divided and still keep all of its physical and chemical properties. So minerals are basically molecules. For example, there's a mineral called quartz, which is a very simple mineral. It's silicon dioxide, SiO2. A molecule of quartz has a silicon atom and two oxygen atoms. So atoms have to combine somehow to make molecules, to make minerals in this case. And how do they do this? Well, they do this by forming chemical bonds. And there's two very important kinds of chemical bonds, ionic and covalent bonds. They're not the only factors to consider, and there are other forces that combine elements together. But from our perspective, ionic and covalent bonding are the two things that are most important. So let's take a look at the next slide to understand this in a little bit more detail. So now to the next slide, which is a summary of bonding types. The chemical bonds are electrical in nature that hold molecules together. And ionic bonds are particularly important. They usually form between metals and nonmetals, and they involve a transfer of an electron. So sodium, for example, loses an electron, becoming a positive ion because it's lost a negative charge, and it gives that electron to chlorine. And we end up with sodium chloride, which we call salt, or we call it halite if we're a geologist, because halite's an important mineral in the natural world. Another example of an ionic compound that's a mineral, of course, is quartz, which is silicon dioxide. One silicon atom and two oxygen atoms, which in this case involves four electrical charges and balances out the molecules. Covalent bonds are a bit different. They're where two elements actually share an electron, so each of them has a full electron shell. They tend to occur between nonmetals. Nonmetals will often share electrons and deceive themselves, if you like, that they have full electron shells. Now, the majority of natural minerals that we deal with in our sciences are what we call ionic compounds. So they're things that form between metals and nonmetals. Now, in some cases, they're organized into groups. make what we call a polyatomic ion. We can have groups of atoms that form ions. For example, the carbonate ion. Carbonate ion is formed from carbon and oxygen, and it has a net 2- charge. Carbonates are quite common on the Earth. There's a lot of carbonate minerals. Limestones are made of carbonates. We also have things like sulfates and sulfides. So we have a wide variety of minerals that we can form as ionic compounds. However, the most important ones that we form are probably the ones we call silicates, and we'll talk about those in just a moment. So let's go to the next slide. This is just a diagrammatic representation of an ionic bond between sodium and chlorine to make the mineral known as halite. So sodium loses an outer electron, that's in its outermost electron shell, and it gives it to chlorine, which fills a gap in its outer electron shell. Both of them are happy, and they are then joined together as the mineral that we call halite. So that's really what an ionic bond is like. Let's take a look at the next slide now. Just briefly, we'll consider covalent bonds in minerals. The best example of this is the mineral that we sometimes call diamond and sometimes call graphite. This is a mineral that consists entirely of carbon atoms. There are actually two different forms of carbon in nature. Graphite is formed of sheets of carbon atoms, which are held together by covalent bonding, that are then stacked together and held together by much weaker forces that we call van der Waals forces that link them together. Diamond, on the other hand, is quite different. It's a continuous three-dimensional network of carbon atoms that are all linked together. So as you can imagine, graphite is a flaky mineral that's quite soft, and diamond is one of the hardest substances we know of. And both of them are just made of carbon. There are other arrangements of carbon atoms that we can make too, things like buckyballs and nanotubes, but these are artificial things. They don't occur in nature. So there are examples of minerals that have covalent bonds, but they are less common. And now to the next slide. So if we're going to make rocks, we have to put together minerals to make rocks. Minerals, most of them, are silicates. Silicates are the most common kinds of minerals. Salt's a very familiar mineral to us, but it's not that common in nature. Minerals come together to make rocks by various kinds of mechanisms. Most rocks are made of more than one mineral. Now, the Earth has several thousand minerals. It has a large number of mineral species. But other planets, as far as we know, have much less variation in the minerals that they contain. But we do find similar minerals on other terrestrial planets, as far as we know, from the observations we've made on the Moon and Mars and other places. By far the most common natural minerals that we see on Earth and in the solar system in general are silicates. And that's because silicon is a very abundant element in the universe. And they're combinations of metals and what we call the silicate iron, or the SiO4 iron. And there are thousands of silicates, and these are the things that build rocks, and ultimately they're the things that build planets too. So let's take a look at the silicate iron and understand what that is. If we take a silicon atom and we put four oxygen atoms around it, we can make a little thing called a tetrahedron. It's a little pyramid-shaped object, okay? It's a four-sided polyhedron. Now, there aren't any actual sticks in there. The atoms are just stuck together by ionic bonding. Now, the net charge on the silicate ion is not zero. Silicon has a net charge of 4+, okay, because it loses four electrons. However, the oxygen atoms there, the oxygen ions have a net charge in total of 8-, because each of them is missing two electrons. So this group of atoms, or group of ions put together, still has a net charge. We make this combination and we have a net charge of -4 left on it. And what we do then to make silicate minerals, we basically use other metals to complement that charge balance, to provide the positive charge, the positive ions that will balance out the net -4 charge of the silicate ion. Next slide, please. So silicate minerals are particularly important because they're polymers. You can join up this basic unit of SiO4 tetrahedra, these little pyramids, in many different ways. You can make chains, you can make rings, you can make sheets of them, and you can make three-dimensional networks of them. So these are very, very stable and durable natural polymers. Other examples of polymers, of course, are things like plastics. which are very common in our world, they're polymers too. Polymers are complex molecules that can be all joined up together to produce very strong and durable materials. So silicate polymers, which make up most of these minerals, are made by combining the SiO4 group, the SiO4 ion, in various forms and adding different metals that will balance out the negative charge. Natural minerals tend to vary in their composition. They don't have fixed compositions like the chemicals in a laboratory would have. They often vary according to their environment. So to the next slide now. What about minerals in the solar system? Well, as I said a few moments ago, there are thousands of different minerals that we know of on the Earth. But from what we know, other planets and things like meteorites and things like that seem far less diverse in terms of their minerals. But we do find some familiar minerals. Some important minerals to remember, there's two minerals here that are magnesium iron silicates that are called olivine and pyroxene. And those two minerals actually make up most of the terrestrial planets in the solar system in a bulk sense. They're not necessarily the most abundant on the surfaces of the planets, but they're the most abundant within the planets too. Another mineral to remember is a mineral called plagioclase. This is a calcium sodium aluminum silicate. This is actually the most abundant mineral in the crust of the Earth, and it's likely very common on all the other terrestrial planets as well. And I'm going to mention two others that you might want to remember. One of them is quartz, silicon dioxide, which is quite common on the Earth, and another one called orthoclase, which is a potassium aluminum silicate. That's also common on the Earth, but they're not very common elsewhere in the solar system as far as we know. We don't see those very much at all. And that's an important observation. So just remember those five minerals to begin with. We will introduce a few others later on, but we're not going to introduce all of the thousands of minerals that occur on the Earth. So now to the next slide. Just show you a few pictures of what these things look like. Here's some pictures of olivine and pyroxene. Now, they don't always look like this. Their color varies. Olivine can be green. It sometimes is brown. Olivine has a gemstone variety, too, that's called peridot. Okay, which can be cut into fine gemstones. So these are two minerals that are essentially iron magnesium silicates. Iron and magnesium are also very common minerals in the universe and in the solar system as well. So let's take a look at the next slide now. Now here's a mineral you should be familiar with because it's the provincial mineral of Newfoundland and Labrador. This is labradorite. Well, labradorite is actually a variety of plagioclase, which we mentioned a few moments ago, probably one of the most common minerals in the Earth's crust. It's actually a rare form of a common mineral. It has a specific composition that allows it to interfere with the wavelengths of reflected light, which is where you get the colours from. And that's what you see in Labrador and many of these occurrences. Anorthosite is another rock type that I'm going to mention at this point. It's a rock type, not a mineral type. It's a rock type dominated by calcium-rich plagioclase. Okay, so that's a rock that's made up largely of a mineral called plagioclase, of which labradorite is a particular variety. Not all plagioclase will look like labradorite, but it all has a fairly similar composition. So to the next slide now. Here are some textbook examples of some other common minerals. This is quartz. You've probably seen quartz crystals. Those white veins you see in the rocks when you walk around the hills around St. John's are usually quartz veins. It's a very simple mineral, silicon dioxide. Orthoclase and a variety of other minerals that we call potassium feldspars are potassium aluminum silicates. They resemble plagioclase in some respects, and they're part of a similar group called feldspars, but they're different in their composition. Plagioclase generally doesn't contain potassium, it contains sodium and calcium. If you mix together quartz, plagioclase and orthoclase, you'll form a common rock type that we call granite. And granite's very common on the continents of the Earth. It's quite common in Newfoundland too. But it doesn't appear that it's a very common rock type on the other terrestrial planets in the solar system. So there's an introduction to some common minerals and a couple of common rock types. We're going to introduce you to a few more in a moment. Next slide then. So this is slide 23. So just to summarize, how do atoms, molecules, minerals and rocks kind of fit together? Well, atoms come together to make molecules, okay? Molecules can combine together to make minerals. Minerals are a type of molecule, just a more complex kind of molecule. and minerals can then combine to make rocks. So minerals are natural chemical compounds, but they are in the end just molecules, combinations of atoms. Rocks are essentially combinations of two or more minerals, which are formed by a variety of different natural processes that are the kinds of things that geologists study. So let's move to the next slide. Rocks in the solar system. Well, as you might expect, terrestrial planets, which resemble the Earth, are made up of rocks. And rocks, of course, are made up of minerals. And so far, it looks as if many of the rocks that we see on terrestrial planets are actually very similar minerals or very similar rocks that we see on the Earth. But it doesn't look, so far, that other terrestrial planets have the same diversity of rock types that we're familiar with on the Earth, which means that they don't contain the same diversity of minerals either. There is one rock type that seems to be very common on all of the planets in the solar system, and that's a rock type that we call basalt. Okay? You've probably heard that term before. This is a very common volcanic rock. We see it in many places on the Earth. For example, the eruptions that we see in Hawaii are eruptions of what we call basaltic lava or basalt lava. And basalt is definitely very common on the Moon, probably on Mercury and Mars too. And so it's very widespread. And basalt is basically a rock that's made up of three minerals that we introduced a little while ago. It's made up of olivine, pyroxene, and plagioclase, plus a few other minor things. And if you were to get a basalt from the Moon and pick it up in one hand and pick up a basalt from the Earth in the other hand, they would look pretty much identical. There are some subtle differences between them, but they're very much the same thing. So this rock type appears to be very common in the terrestrial planets of the solar system, which in itself must be significant. So now to the next slide. Now, igneous rocks that we see on the surface of the Earth are what we call lavas. Now, we're pretty familiar with these because we've all seen pictures of erupting volcanoes. There's no doubt that there are volcanoes on other planets in the solar system as well. We certainly know that they exist on Mars and on Venus, and they used to exist on the Moon and Mercury as well. So we're familiar with these. So lavas, or volcanic rocks, are one type of a group of rocks that we call igneous rocks, rocks that basically cool from a molten state. So let's just review a few important facts about these. Igneous rocks are one of three families of rocks that geologists recognize. They form when molten rock cools or solidifies, okay, as a lava or a magma. A magma is basically the same thing as a lava, but inside the Earth. But we also have two other groups of rocks that we're very familiar with on Earth. We have a group of rocks called sedimentary rocks, and most of these form by breaking up and moving loose material that's derived from other rock types, particularly igneous rocks, and accumulating them together somewhere. Sometimes they precipitate directly from water or by the accumulation of shells and dead organisms and things like that. So sedimentary rocks are the kind that form beds and layers. Most of the rocks you see around St. John's are sedimentary rocks, but they're hundreds of millions of years old. There are definitely some sedimentary rocks on Mars because we've seen these, but we don't have any evidence of sedimentary rocks on any other solar system body or any other planet at this point. The third group of rocks that we recognize on Earth are called metamorphic rocks. And these are basically formed from other rocks as a result of subjecting them to elevated temperatures, pressures, or other types of chemical reactions. Metamorphism means to change shape in Latin or in Greek. They're very common on Earth. You find a lot of these, particularly in Canada. But we're much less certain about their occurrence elsewhere in the solar system. We don't know definitively that they do exist. So there are many different types of rocks on Earth, but we can break them basically into these three types. Igneous, which comes from a molten state. Sedimentary, derived usually by wearing away, transporting and depositing other types of rocks. And metamorphic rocks that we form from other rock types by subjecting them to temperatures, pressures, or chemical reactions. So just bear that in mind, and let's now look at igneous rocks in a little bit more detail. Next slide. Igneous rocks can be divided into two types that we typically call volcanic and plutonic. So a volcanic igneous rock is something we're very familiar with. That's a lava. That's like the stuff that comes out of Hawaii in an eruption. Most eruptions on the Earth actually take place underwater. Basalt is by far the most common type of volcanic rock on the Earth, but other types do exist as well. What we call a plutonic rock It's really the same thing, but it's not cooling on the surface of the Earth. It's cooling at depth much more slowly, and so it's forming larger crystals and masses of crystals, which are much easier to see. And two rock types we've introduced a little bit, the one we call granite and the one we call anorthosite, are both plutonic rocks. So a magma, basically, is the deep version of a lava. A lava is just a magma that comes to the surface. Remember the difference between those two things. Lavas build up volcanoes, but they differ quite a lot. Some of them are explosive volcanoes. Mount St. Helens is a famous eruption of an explosive volcano. Some of them are not explosive. We haven't seen too much evidence of explosive volcanoes elsewhere in the solar system yet. Another important thing about volcanic activity is that it usually involves fluids and vapors too. Volcanoes are important sources of gases, things like steam, carbon dioxide and sulfur in gaseous form. And these come from deep within the Earth. And this is likely the same on other planets as well. Last but not least, we know that volcanoes are quite abundant in the solar system, but many of them do seem to be extinct. We see them on Venus, but we've never seen one erupt. We've seen them on Mars, but they're probably extinct, or at least very close to extinct. We know that they were once quite abundant on the Moon and Mercury, but these smaller planets now appear to be geologically dead. So that's a little bit about igneous rocks on Earth and within the solar system. Let's look at a couple of pictures which are a little more interesting, a little easier to look at than all these text slides. Next slide. So here's a couple of pictures of familiar volcanoes. The one on the top is the most familiar type of volcano. Geologists call it a stratovolcano. And many of the famous volcanoes are made of these things. That's what they look like. We don't know that these exist other than on the Earth. They might exist in some places on Venus. The other kind of volcano we see on Earth are what we call shield volcanoes. These have a very different shape. They're much broader, flat mountains. They're often eroded. Hawaii is a shield volcano, but it's the erosion by rain and other forces that creates its steep shape. But they're formed by basaltic eruptions. Shield volcanoes are a typical type of volcano that forms from the eruption of basalt. These are lavas that had low viscosities, they flowed very easily, so they weren't able to build steep-sided mountains in the same way. And we know that these are quite abundant in the solar system. We see them on Mars, and we see them on other planets as well. So that's the two basic kinds of volcanoes. So now to another picture of somewhere that should be very familiar to you. Everyone knows where this is. This is the Grand Canyon. It's kind of like a shrine for geological time, but also for the accumulation of sedimentary rocks. The Grand Canyon largely consists of sedimentary rocks, which are flat-lying beds or units that have been laid down in an ancient sea. You don't have to go to the canyon to see this. You can see beds and units of sedimentary rocks all around St. John's forming layers. Most sedimentary rocks form in water-rich settings. The bulk of sedimentary rocks are related to the presence of water, even in oceans or lakes or rivers. And as I said a few moments ago, at the present time, Mars is the only other place in the solar system where we know that sedimentary rocks exist. It's also the only place in the solar system where we're confident that water once existed. So that's an important observation. One thing about sedimentary rocks is that we can match them up. We can match the layers up over huge distances. And you can see in this photograph that there's a little marker there showing you two thick beds. These are limestone beds at the top of the Grand Canyon sequence. And we can actually link them together across the canyon. So they're fairly continuous. And that's another feature of sedimentary rocks, is that they form semi-continuous layers that in a way give us a history. This is how we derive much of the geological record that we understand on Earth, is by looking at sedimentary rocks of different ages. So let's go to the next slide now. Here's some ancient sedimentary rocks. This was a photo taken in the Bay of Islands this summer. So they're tilted because the Earth is a dynamic planet. They've been moved around and they've been disrupted. But they're the same kind of thing. They formed in a deeper ocean than the rocks of the Grand Canyon, but in an oceanic basin by sediment that was brought down by rivers and deposited in the ocean and eventually accumulated. And now to the next slide. These are also sedimentary rocks that occur in the Bay of Islands area. And here they're showing you that sedimentary rocks can be folded and deformed and twisted and disrupted. This is a fold. These are thick layers of sandstone in with a rock type that we call shale. That's the black stuff. And you can see they've been folded over. That's part of the process that generated the Appalachian Mountains of eastern Canada. So Earth is a dynamic place. Rocks can form by one process and are now uplifted above sea level and contain these structures that suggest that they've been folded and pushed and deformed and tilted by the forces of the Earth. So they also provide us with a record of that. So let's have a look at the next slide now. This is another location in Newfoundland. This is in Bonavista Bay. This is a bedding plane. It's something that represents an ancient subsea surface from millions of years ago, about 560 million years ago. It's covered in these little polygonal patterns here. Now, these should be familiar to you because you've probably seen mud cracks in puddles that have dried up. And this is exactly the same thing. This is a surface that dried up when the sea level fell. And then another unit of sedimentary rocks was laid down on top of it when sea level rose again. So sedimentary rocks also provide us with clues to ancient environments. Now, so far, nobody has found mud cracks on Mars. But I would predict that the environment that exists on Mars is probably one where we will eventually find sedimentary features that resemble these, telling us that water was there, but then it dried up, and then it came back again. So let's go to the next slide now. Now, this one is not from Newfoundland. It's just to illustrate some other important features that geologists look for. We look for things that tell us the relative timing of events. In the upper photo there, you can see some sedimentary rocks, and you can see two prominent whitish layers within them. But you can see that they've been broken and shifted by a little line that runs through from top to bottom. That line's what we call a fault. It's a break in the crust of the Earth that's moved those rock layers. Now, obviously, that fault has to be younger than the actual rock layers themselves. The rock layers had to exist before the fault could form. So we deduce the timing there, too. In the other photograph, we see two things that we call dikes. These are dikes of basalt. They're volcanic rocks. They were probably feeders to lavas on the surface. And you can see that they're cutting right through sedimentary rocks that in fact are folded at this location. So again, we know the relative timing here. We know that those sedimentary rocks had to form, they then had to become rock-like and solid, and they had to be folded before they cracked and the lava flowed through them to form the dikes. So this is how geologists on Earth build up chronological stories that represent the geological record. We're a very long way from being able to do this kind of thing on other planets, but in time, we hopefully will be able to do this, particularly in places like Mars, to understand events as they took place over time. So now to the next slide. We have a very important way of linking events in time as geologists on the Earth. We actually use fossils. Fossils record the evolution of organisms, and they're abundant through the latter part of the geological record, about the last 500 million years or so. If we find two rock layers that contain the same distinctive fossils, that tells us that those two rock layers formed during the same time interval. So looking at fossil assemblages is critical in a branch of geological science that we call stratigraphy, which is the study of strata, if you like, the study of sedimentary sequences. And this is how the geological record is constructed on Earth. Now, one of these days, we might discover fossils in Martian sedimentary rocks. That will be an incredibly important discovery, both from the perspective of understanding the evolution of life in the universe, but also eventually in understanding the chronology of events on Mars and what happened on Mars in the past. So geology is really all about establishing the geological record and understanding that geological record. We have a very good geological record on the Earth, although it's incomplete in many respects, particularly in its early stages. We have a very rudimentary understanding of the geological record of other planets. Now to the next slide. Some of the most complex rocks that we find on Earth are what we call metamorphic rocks. This is one from the coast of Labrador near Hopedale. This is more than 3 billion years old, but that's still a lot younger than the Earth itself. Now, once upon a time, that was an igneous rock of some kind. It might have been some kind of granite. But then it was subjected to enormous pressures at high temperatures for very long periods of time, which caused it to start melting to produce all that light colored stuff. And that is an indication of the dynamic nature of the Earth. the fact that we find metamorphic rocks which are produced by, transformed by heat and pressure. That means that we had to take some kind of rock and we had to bury it deep in the earth for long periods of time and cook it up, and then we had to bring it back up to the surface of the earth in order to find it today. So that tells us, tellingly, very importantly, how dynamic the earth is as a planet. And we need to compare that perhaps to what we see elsewhere in the solar system. So now to the next slide. This simplistically shows you what we call the rock cycle on Earth. And this is an expression of the dynamic nature of the Earth, if you like. We form igneous rocks from magmas. They're volcanic or they're plutonic, it doesn't really matter. We uplift them. They become subjected to weather. They get rained on. The wind whips them up. They get eroded. They get weathered. They get transported by rivers. They get dropped off in the ocean where they make sediment, which becomes a sedimentary rock layer, one of many, many sedimentary rock layers. Sometimes they're uplifted again and just get eroded again. Sometimes they're taken down into the earth to depth, where they're heated and pressurized to become metamorphic rocks, which can then be uplifted to be eroded again. So this is like an endless process that we see on the Earth, where the dynamic planet is moving material around on its surface and within its outer layers. Very, very important feature of the Earth. And we don't know of anywhere in the solar system where this kind of process takes place at the present time. So now to the next slide. This is a map of Earth's tectonic plates. We showed you this in the introduction slide as well, or something very similar. Earth's outer surface is in constant but very slow motion. And it's the boundaries between tectonic plates that tell us where geological activity takes place on the Earth. If you look at most of those boundaries, some of them are in the oceans where there are volcanic chains, some of them are in land where there are mountain chains. So the boundaries between tectonic plates and the motion of tectonic plates in response to the interior motion of the Earth is very important in controlling its behavior. So now to the next slide. Why is the Earth such a dynamic planet? Well, the biggest reason, of course, is that it's got internal heat and energy. We talked about energy before. It's got energy that's left over from its formation and also provided by radioactive decay. A smaller planet is going to cool much more quickly. Smaller objects have much higher surface area to volume ratios. They cool more quickly. The other reason the Earth is dynamic is because the materials on the surface of the Earth and those that are inside most of the planet behave differently. And this brings us to the concept of what we call the lithosphere. And this is an important word in planetary science because it's important in understanding the behavior of different types of planets within the solar system. So let's go to the next slide and understand what this means. So this is a very schematic summary of Earth's internal structure. The outer part of the Earth, which is about 150 kilometers thick, is what we call the lithosphere. And that's a region that's relatively cool, and it's relatively rigid, and it's relatively brittle. And that's what we live on, because we wouldn't be able to live on it if it wasn't like that. And it includes the crust of the Earth, and it includes a portion of the what's called the mantle of the Earth. Now, the mantle of the Earth is largely made up of silicate igneous rocks, mostly of olivine and pyroxene. But as we go down in the Earth, those silicate igneous rocks become hotter. And that means that they become ductile. Their physical behavior changes. They become plastic and they're able to flow on very long timescales. Now, the interior regions of the Earth, which we won't talk about now, actually consist of metal-rich material, mostly of iron and nickel. And these form what we call the core of the Earth. But we're going to leave that discussion for now. Let's just focus on the outer part. So on Earth, we have a relatively thin lithosphere, as much as 150 kilometers thick underneath the continents, but a lot less than that underneath the oceans. And that's the cool and rigid part. And that's sitting on something that's able to flow and move. So let's have a look at the next slide to see the contrast between this and what we might see elsewhere. So why is the lithosphere important? Well, it will break rather than flow. And that's what gives us the tectonic plates. Down below the lithosphere, the deeper regions of the Earth's mantle contain some water, and they're under great pressure and they're hot. And that means that they can move on long timescales. So the lithosphere is relatively thin on the Earth. Heat can get through it. It can break through in regions of high heat flow. And it can be moved as well. It moves in response to the underlying motion of the mantle. That's what gives us the motion of tectonic plates, which is also known as continental drift. You've probably heard this term. The Earth's continents move around on the surface of the planet on a very long time scale. This likely does not happen elsewhere. We believe, for example, that smaller planets that we see in the solar system, the Moon, Mercury and Mars, have much thicker lithospheres. They're not able to respond in this way. So now to the next slide. This is continental drift in action on the Earth. This shows the movement of the Earth's continents over a long period of about 250 million years. At that time, they were all fused together to make a supercontinent, actually the most recent of quite a number of supercontinents that have existed in the Earth's history. But since that time, they've broken apart. The Atlantic Ocean has formed between North America and Africa and Laurasia, and the Indian Ocean has formed too. India has moved across the Indian Ocean, eventually colliding with Asia to make the Himalayas, and the Pacific Ocean has begun to shrink. So that's an example of continental drift that is well constructed from the geological record that we now have on the Earth. Do other planets have lithospheres? Well, yes, they do. They have to have lithospheres as well, but smaller planets are going to have very thick lithospheres in comparison to the Earth, because they are colder inside. They have less heat flow. They've lost more heat. So those lithospheres are too thick and strong to be mobile like the Earth's lithosphere is. The Earth's lithosphere can move in response to underlying things, but probably this is not the case. Now, we're not sure about Venus. Venus is a different case entirely. In theory, it's very similar to the Earth, so we would expect it to have a relatively thin lithosphere. But Venus also lacks water, which complicates the picture. But anyway, just get this idea in your head that the lithosphere is the outer, brittle and rigid region of a planet, and the thickness of that lithosphere is important in controlling the behavior of that planet and its evolution. So let's move along now onto another topic. We're getting close to the end, you'll be happy to know. So here's some pictures from the Moon. When you look at the Moon with a telescope, what you see most of all are craters. And the same is true for Mercury and many other smaller bodies in the solar system too. Their surfaces are essentially made up of impact craters. So that's quite different than what we see on the Earth. We do have impact craters on the Earth, and they've been an important influence on the Earth, but very few of them are preserved now. The Earth is a dynamic planet. It erases this evidence of this process. The smaller bodies of the solar system contain abundant evidence of impact processes. They have been bombarded by asteroids and meteorites and bits of rock for billions of years. And if we look carefully, we can see superimposed relationships. We can tell the relationships here. If you look 1, 2, and 3 in this photograph, those are progressively younger craters. The older craters had to exist before the younger ones were formed. So that tells us that the surfaces of these planets, these bodies, are ancient and largely unchanging. They're not changing very much because they're preserving all of this history of impact cratering. And that's not a record that we see on the Earth. So they're telling us something about the early days of the solar system. They're also telling us that the surface processes that exist on the Moon and on Mercury are totally different to the ones that exist on the Earth. Mars is an interesting case. We don't know too much about Mars's evolution. It's possible that it had some more mobile episodes in its early history, but we don't really know that yet. So just bear in mind that not all planets have the same surface processes. So now to the next slide. This essentially summarizes what I just told you in respect to the diagram. Okay. Some planets in the solar system really don't have surfaces at all. The giant planets don't really have solid surfaces, but those that do have solid surfaces form two extremes. Earth is one extreme. It's a very mobile, dynamic surface that's changed quite a lot. It's removed a lot of the evidence for early events. At the other extreme, we have the Mercury and Moon. One other thing to bear in mind, too, about this is that once we go into the outer solar system, materials are familiar, but at the same time, they can be pretty strange, too. So if you get down to 140 degrees below zero centigrade, behavior of ice will behave essentially like rock. It's going to be very strong and it's going to be very hard. Volcanoes can actually erupt water or salty water instead of lavas in the outer solar system. So we have processes out there that sort of resemble volcanic processes on the Earth, but they involve ice and water. We can also have places where solid gases are going to behave like an ice glacier would do on the Earth. If we go to Pluto, we can find glaciers made of frozen nitrogen. So it's quite possible for some parts of the outer solar system to have fairly dynamic surfaces on planets because the temperature range that they're dealing with is completely different. Okay? So what applies in the inner system may not apply in the outer system from a geological perspective. So now to the next slide, which is another change in direction. I want to just mention something called the Earth system concept. Plate tectonics and continental drift was a paradigm that was developed in the 20th century. The Earth system concept, as I mentioned in the introduction, is more of a 21st century concept that links together the different parts of the Earth to try and understand the way in which they interact and the way in which they control the behavior of the planet. And as time goes on, we're more and more aware of the links between all of these things. So to the next slide. These complex interactions basically are what maintain the surface environment of the Earth, but they also have had a massive impact on the evolutionary path of the Earth system, the Earth as a whole. And it's likely that the biosphere itself and the hydrosphere influence internal processes in the Earth as well. So this is like a delicate balancing act that has worked here for 4 billion years and counting for a period beyond that. And it's maintained a relatively constant surface environment. We know that there's been water on the surface of the Earth for about 4 billion years, as far as we know, and maybe before that too. So when we look at other worlds within the solar system, we also have to think of these as planetary systems. But it's quite clear that Venus and Mars have evolved on very different paths through time compared to the Earth. But there's no reason to assume that what we now see on Venus and Mars is exactly what always existed. Okay. On the Earth, our system appears to have been relatively constant in its characteristics, but it still has changed a lot over time, largely through the actions of the biosphere. So now to the next slide. You should be familiar with this material. This is a demonstration of the water cycle. You can find this in any high school science book. The water cycle is just another expression of the dynamic nature of the Earth's surface. Condensation, evaporation, water running through the surface environment, eroding, and moving material to the oceans. This is just one small part of the Earth's system, which consists of numerous cycles that move material around in a very complicated way and have very long-term consequences. So now let's go to the next slide. We are getting close to the end. I'm always happy to get to the end of these classes. So now we're going to jump really to a modern concept, the concept of climate change. We've talked about changes in the Earth's system. The Earth system is remarkably stable, but it does change over time. And right now it's changing quite significantly. So this graph would show the average global temperature relative to 1970 over quite a long period of time since the Industrial Revolution. Now people argue about the details of these things, but I don't think it's possible to argue with the trend that you see here. There's been a change in average surface temperatures on the Earth that's quite noticeable. Changes of 2 degrees centigrade or less essentially define the differences between our climate and the ice age that preceded our present times, and they will make a big difference in the future as well. And if we go and we look, for example, in the next slide, we see the relationship between global temperatures over 800,000 years and the concentration of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. So it's very clear that there's a relationship here between the atmosphere of the Earth and its climate. The presence of carbon dioxide is associated with warmer intervals compared to cooler intervals, which have lower carbon dioxide concentrations. You should know something about this. We're not going to talk about climate change in great detail in this course, but it's a very important illustration of the fact that the human species is able to influence the Earth system and has influenced the Earth system and will continue to do so in some way over the coming hundreds of years, the coming centuries, or even millennia. Okay, so the biosphere has for a long time had an influence on the evolution of the Earth system, and we are just part of the biosphere that is now having a rather disproportionate effect on the biosphere. So to a nearly final slide, this is part of a larger collection of things that we need to be worried about at the moment. climate change is just one of the aspects of what we think of as global change. Global change in the Earth system to a large extent is due to human activity. So this has large implications for Earth as a planet on the whole. COVID-19 is a fairly small problem compared to some of the other ones that we may face in the future. And now you'll be grateful to know that we have finally reached the end of this presentation. I'm pretty grateful to get here, I can tell you that. And let's just look at the last slide. Now, you might have seen this before. What do you think that is, and how does it happen? Well, in the next class, we're going to go and look at some of the historical observations of the sky and some of the things that humans have been interested in understanding and trying to explain, and we'll talk about this in more detail then. So, I'm going to bid you good night now. I'm kind of tired. It's been a long day. Running this radio solar system business is a fair bit of work, I can tell you that. But it is fun in a way. We're going to learn some interesting things over the coming weeks, and I hope to meet you all again in a short while for another broadcast in the series. Thank you very much. Good night. Have a good time.